The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last month, when Eddie Murphy took the mic to accept the prestigious Mark Twain Prize for American humor, he opened his remarks with a pointed jab at one of his childhood heroes, a man who'd won that same award in 2009, Bill Cosby.
Bill has one of these. Did y'all make Bill give his back?
From Eddie Murphy to Chris Rock to Jerry Seinfeld, comics who were deeply influenced by Cosby are now grappling with how to handle his tarnished reputation, doing everything from removing their blurbs from Cosby's biography to calling him out on social media and in interviews. But comedian Greg Fitzsimmons is choosing a different route, one that he believes will hit Cosby where it hurts. Greg Fitzsimmons is a stand-up comic. He's an Emmy Award-winning comedy writer and host of the podcast FitzDog Radio. And Greg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's nice to be one of the mouths that are making words on your show today.
That's really, it takes a special talent, as you know.
Well, you know, it's talking nonstop has become my life. I do podcasts and radio shows and stand-up, and I really get sick of my own voice sometimes.
Well, we're glad to have it with us today, so it's
Thank
a treat
you.
For us. Well, you've been a comedian for nearly 30 years. Was Bill Cosby an influence for you?
Yeah, I mean, you're asked that a lot as a comedian. Who are your influences? And my go-to comics were, I would always say, George Carlin and Bill Cosby, because I think that as a kid, my father was really into him, and I remember reading his books and listening to his stand-up. I'm a comedy album collector. And I've got, I think, all of his albums. And I think that what was devastating about this is, you know, feeling for the women and what they've gone through, and feeling like because of the stupid statute of limitation laws that nothing is possibly going to be done to this guy. And so you start thinking, like, I've always been kind of a vigilante. Like, I would punch somebody in the face many times in my life because of what they were doing to somebody else. And I think, how do I punch Bill Cosby in the face? And so I decided to just start allocating his material.
That's kind of a cardinal sin in comedy, isn't it? Stealing another comic's material?
It's the worst thing you can do. And I've been doing this for 26 years. And I've got a pretty good reputation for having never done it. And now I feel like it's a point I'm trying to make, which is, you know, can you separate the artist from the art? And I'm going on stage to basically say, what a shame that this great material is being lost, because I don't know that you can listen or look at Bill Cosby doing comedy anymore and appreciate this great body of work because, you know, it's being performed by a serial rapist, alleged.
Well, okay, we say alleged serial rapist. We thought a lot about, like, how we should use that term. Let's just say a man against whom many very convincing allegations have been made.
Yes, and a man who is famous for doing a routine now about Spanish Fly.
Okay, so let me ask you, are there some pieces like that you probably wouldn't do of Bill Cosby's now? You know, what's the kind of line for the stuff that you're reappropriating?
I try to do the classics, you know, Noah and the dentist office. And I basically go up and I try to do the bit without telling the audience what I'm doing. I want to take it as far as I can without them noticing. And then some people you can start to see are sort of curious about why I'm doing a Bill Cosby routine, and then I'll generally introduce rape into the routine. You know, like the dentist ends up gassing the patient. Noah is giving Dramamine to all the animals and having sex with them. So it's, you know, at the end, it's a satirical take on it. But I try to keep it as straight as I can. I don't do an impression of him, but I try to do the bit as close to the way he does it as possible.
So how do audiences react once they know that it's a Bill Cosby bit?
Well, that's the thing, is I never wanted this to be something that glorified Bill Cosby. That was my worst nightmare about this. I wanted it to be, again, a statement about whether or not these jokes can be performed by somebody else. Can we save this good material? But ultimately, it's just about, you know, trying to make them see the bit as a performance piece. And unfortunately, they were laughing at the bit so much that I think I'm done. I think I'm out of this project, because it just felt like I couldn't get the audience to laugh in the way that I wanted them, which is laughing at the idea of trying to hurt Bill Cosby. Oh, and instead, they're laughing at it in a way that shows an appreciation of the material.
Well, when I first heard about it, it made me kind of uncomfortable. I just thought, you know, is he elevating his material? Shouldn't we just let him disappear?
I think that's ultimately how I feel about it. And, you know, I went into this not really knowing what the beats of the piece were and, you know, how it would completely play out. I just knew that, you know, I felt this anger towards him, and I felt like, okay, he's already got all these women suing him. He's got people no longer showing up to his shows. And what else can we do to hurt Bill Cosby? And to me, it was like, let's take his material and take it from him and then bastardize it. But in the end, I felt like what you said. I feel like let's let this guy just go away and hopefully be prosecuted and put away.
Well, he has had honorary degrees taken away from him. 35 of his accusers had their portraits on the cover of New York Magazine. Few, if any, besides his wife so far, defenders left. Yet he remains just defiantly closed mouth. Do you think this will rattle him? Do you think you'll hear from his attorney about a cease and desist?
Well, you know, I talked to my lawyer about it just to make sure I wasn't getting on the wrong side of things. And I'm fine, because this is considered parody, which you're allowed to do a certain amount of somebody's material if it's parody. But I hope so. And that really is my hope. That was my number one goal, is can I annoy Bill Cosby? Because in a system where, until we can change the laws about statutory rape, until we can, you know, make changes in our this culture of rape that we have there, where women take this long to come forward because they're ashamed and they blame themselves, and society will still do what people like Damon Wayans did, where they said these women are gold diggers. You know, until the dynamic changes in our society, men will continue to get away with these heinous crimes. Not once, but it's just hard to wrap your head around that it can happen allegedly 40 times and there's no recourse.
Well, there is a possibility of civil suits, of course. And it's not as if the allegations are recent news. The civil suit he settled with Andrea Constan was in the news in 2006. At the time, other women had made claims. I mean, I can't help but think, where was the outrage back then?
I remember reading that there was an article in Rolling Stone magazine. I don't know. I'd be guessing by saying 15 years ago. And I remember saying, why is this not getting picked up by the mainstream media? And you look back at the history of celebrities, you know, being accused of sexual misconduct. You know, you go back to Michael Jackson and Roman Polanski, you know, Tupac Shakur. And they all were dismissed. The charges were brought. And when people have deep pockets, these cases just seem to go away, and the press seems to go away. And Bill Cosby was a very powerful guy, and his image was very protected by mainstream community, certainly by African-American community, and we didn't choose to explore it anymore.
Well, Polanski is such an interesting case, because he pleaded guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor, and then won an Academy Award for Best Director decades later, while the audience at the Academy Awards gave him a standing ovation.
Right.
So why do you think an artist like Polanski does not face the same kind of scrutiny?
I think we hope these things aren't true. And, you know, again, going back to the whole rape culture thing, we will meld our minds around obvious evidence that's being presented to not believe that a beloved figure is capable of a crime like that at the expense of the victim. And, you know, you look at Michael Jackson. I mean, we're still at weddings dancing to his music when he paid off how many families because he had some kind of inappropriate contact with their children. And again, it's alleged, but you can see the power that these people wield and how they can make stories go away.
You said earlier, can we separate the man from his art? You know, and Fatty Arbuckle in the 1920s, you know, created a big scandal and kind of went away. Miles Davis allegedly beat up women, and we love his music. Is there, you know, a kind of statute of limitations on holding somebody accountable and guilty before the admiration takes over again?
Well, that's the question. I mean, look at how many people, Jewish people, walk down the aisle to Wagner, who is a, you know, voracious anti-Semite. And so that's the question, is the line moves for every celebrity and for every person that's listening to their work or watching their work. And there's no easy answer to that. And again, when you go back to these cases not being convictions, but rather being allegations that are somehow mysteriously settled and us not wanting to believe it, I can tell you, like, for people that do steal jokes, and there's a lot of, I'm not going to name drop, but some of the biggest comedians in the business have stolen jokes, you know, word for word. And the audience doesn't care. Comedians get outraged, but the average audience member, they want to laugh. They want to go to a show. And if somebody is humorous and edgy or whatever they're looking for, and they find out they stole, they kind of shove it in the back of their minds because it's not as important to them as that they're getting entertainment value out of something.
Greg Fitzsimmons, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Fitzsimmons, stand-up comic and an Emmy Award-winning comedy writer, and the mouth of the podcast Fitzdog Radio. You'll find a link to his work at wordofmouthradio.org. In 1873, the Comstock Law was passed, which outlawed obscene, lewd, or lascivious materials from being passed through the postal system. It was named after Anthony Comstock, a moral reformer who was then put in charge of enforcing the law, making him one of America's most powerful censors. Backstory producer Nina Ernest brings us this story of one of Comstock's most eccentric targets.
In the 1890s, a stenographer named Ida Craddock embarked on a new career as a couples counselor.
Little Dr. Ruth, how you could improve your sex life, but also a marriage therapist trying to figure out what's gone wrong in these relationships and why there's so much estrangement in any given marriage.
This is Lee Schmidt, a historian at Washington University in St. Louis. He says that Craddock was in a unique position, as there weren't a lot of self-styled sex therapists in buttoned-up Gilded Age America. But Craddock herself was unmarried in her late 30s. So when she started talking publicly about sex and sex reform, some wondered how a chaste woman would know anything about this topic.
And she says, well, the reason I have this knowledge is I think I could speak of this as a wife. It's just that she's a wife of a spirit.
In other words, she believed she had a husband who was a ghost. Craddock, like many Americans of her era, was swept up in the spiritualist religious movement. She believed that she had reconnected with an old love who had died, and that she was now having intimate relations with this spirit. Schmidt says that Craddock knew the public would think she was crazy, so she wrote,
"How far the reader may value my testimony as being the result of my personal experience.
He will, of course, decide according to his bias for or against the possibility of communication with our deceased friends beyond the grave. However, I can truthfully say that I have gained from it a knowledge of sex relations that many years of reading and discussions with other people never brought me."
Armed with her celestial sexual expertise, Craddock wrote 6 pamphlets full of advice for married couples. These pamphlets supplemented her meager income. Customers would request a copy, and she would sell them for about 50 cents apiece. But she had to mail them. And that's how she ran up against Anthony Comstock and his censorship regime.
He basically worked under the aegis of the post office and seized anything that he found to be offensive.
This is Craig LeMay, a journalism professor at Northwestern University. He says that it didn't take much to offend Comstock. The moral reformer saw obscenity everywhere, not just in dirty pictures, but in works of art and even medical textbooks.
Anytime he learned about someone engaged in some activity, whether it was an art gallery or a physician offering contraceptive services, or whether it was a book dealer, he would basically make a solicitation for services or products, and then the moment they were provided to him, he would arrest them. He basically did entrapment.
Comstock claimed that he and his network of informants confiscated 160 tons of allegedly obscene material and prosecuted over 3,500 people. The eccentric Ida Craddock was one of them. Post office agents, appalled by her pamphlet's explicit references to sexuality, brought federal cases against her in Philadelphia, Chicago, and Washington, D.C.
All you have to do to prove that something is obscene literature is to point to a single passage in a text and show that that passage could incite lascivious thoughts in someone.
Prosecutors would read her marital advice out loud in the courtroom. In one pamphlet, called The Wedding Night, she wrote that it was a wife's duty to, quote, perform pelvic movements.
Women have been so taught to be passionless, have been so taught that they try not to show any feeling. So she's trying, you know, to get people to move. And you read that in court, you're pretty much guaranteed you're going to be seen as wildly obscene.
Craddock fought Comstock by claiming that she had the protection of the First Amendment. You know, the one that says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. There was just one problem.
For the most part, what he did, nobody thought of then as raising any kind of First Amendment issue.
That's Craig LeMay again. He says the Supreme Court didn't set the precedent for a modern understanding of freedom of speech until later in the 20th century. So for Craddock and others, the most famous amendment wasn't a ready defense against Comstock and his agents.
They didn't have any legal precedent to rely on. I mean, there weren't any First Amendment cases to fall back on. So they might have argued in some abstract way for a right to speak freely, but they simply would not have formulated the arguments that way, and they didn't.
Craddock never won a case, but she did manage to avoid jail time, at least until 1902. That year, she relocated to New York City. And despite knowing the risks, she continued to send out her pamphlets.
I think at that point, she really saw herself as standing for religious freedom, freedom of the press, freedom of expression. In some ways, I think she's courting this climactic showdown with Comstock.
This time, Comstock arrested her in person. She first had a state trial, which she lost, and spent 3 months in a workhouse. The prison was overcrowded, filled with vermin, and had no running water.
It's after she gets out of jail for that 3-month sentence, and as she's awaiting the federal trial, that she's very fearful at this point, that because she's been tried so many times and is such a repeat offender, that she's going to get the maximum sentence. So she's got it into her head. She's going to get a 5-year sentence.
She was 45, and based on her 3 months in the workhouse,
she doesn't think she's going to survive in jail.
Craddock lost her federal trial. She had nothing to do but wait for her sentencing on October 17th, 1902. That day, she was found dead in her apartment. Ida Craddock had sealed the room, filled it with gas, and slit her wrist. The marriage reformer left 2 notes behind, one for her mother and one to the public.
I resolved that if again attacked by Comstockism, I would stand my ground and fight to the death. Perhaps the American people may be shocked into investigating the dreadful state of affairs which permits that unctuous, sexual hypocrite, Anthony Comstock, to wax fat and arrogant and to trample upon the liberties of the people. invading in my own case, both my right to freedom of religion and to freedom of the press.
She stages it well. Her suicide becomes this cause celeb among free speech activists, and they pound Comstock for, as they see it, driving this innocent, pure-minded woman to her death. It's a setback for him. It becomes one of the cases that really he has a hard time living down.
And she was by no means the only one. He used to boast about people who committed suicide. When he prosecuted people and they committed suicide, he thought his work was done. He took credit, I believe, for at least 15 different suicides.
Her death didn't bring Comstock down. He was on a crusade to protect American youth from obscenity, a major concern for the public. So he kept his position until he died in 1915.
Comstock, as most people now view him, as kind of a blot on the American history of free expression. Okay, I buy that. But at the same time, for most of his career, he had the support of the press, he had the support of powerful people, and he had public opinion on his side.
In the 20th century, the Supreme Court would expand Americans' right to free expression. Too late for Ida Craddock.
And that story was produced by Backstory's Nina Ernest.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
A new online study has confirmed a sad truth about our listening habits, that people over the age of 33 effectively stop discovering new music and are doomed to recycle the hits of their youth. Well, it may be hard to believe. After all, so many people talk about the important role that music plays in their lives. So we sent our producer, Molly Donahue, around the office to see what people had to say about their musical habits.
So how old are you?
I'm 36 years old.
25.
33.
I am 39 years old.
I'm 24.
Okay, and then when is the last time you bought or got into new music?
That's a good question.
Gosh.
Last time I bought music was online.
A few months ago, maybe in the summer. Or last summer, a Mahalia Jackson record.
Well, new music for me is old music.
I've gone the last couple of years. I've gone a few times to the broadcast of the Met Opera they do. Got new music. I mean, new to me.
I hope where you're going with this is the fact that, like, my identity was, like, getting into new artists for, like, my entire youth up until I went to college. Like, I don't know what happened.
Well, I would like to blame it on a baby. I just had a baby, but she's only 4 months, so I can't really blame it on that.
One of my first jobs was working at a CD store. I would collect CDs like crazy. I had hundreds of them. I sold off all of them, and now I regret having sold off all of them, and I haven't, like, replaced those old listening habits with anything new yet. I listen to Pandora a lot and the radio a lot, but you hear the same stuff again and again.
A thoroughly unscientific sampling of the NHPR staff there talking about how they discover, or rather do not discover, new music nowadays. Well, Gabe Moline rejects the notion that age prevents us from getting our groove on. He's music editor at KQED Arts in California, where he recently wrote an essay called Keep Listening, Notes on Turning 40 and Still Seeking Out New Music. Gabe, welcome to the program.
Hey, pleasure to be here.
So is this borne out by people you know, that research that people pretty much stop discovering new music after 30-something?
Well, anecdotally, you can see it all over the place in, you know, middle-aged people wearing Ramones t-shirts or, you know, AC/DC shirts. But there was a recent study, actually, earlier this year that determined through, I believe, Spotify data that people really stopped seeking out new music by the age of 33 and just listened to the music they liked in high school or the music they liked in college. And that was incredibly depressing to me.
Well, why do you think we stop or people stop?
I don't know. Music for a lot of people is a nostalgic thing connected to their youth. Like I say in this piece, I remember my mom telling me once that the music you like in high school is going to be your favorite music for the rest of your life.
Oh, my goodness.
And with this study, it boggled my mind because 33 was about the time that I started not wanting to listen to any music that I'd heard before and became really ravenous and exploratory for new sounds.
But to be fair, you are a musician. You work. Your job constantly exposes you to new music. Not everybody out there gets new music mailed to them.
That is true. However, I'm like everyone else. I get bombarded with, YouTube links in my text messages and people telling me, 20 new bands that I have to listen to tonight and report back to them in the morning and tell them how much I love them. There's so much music, and it's coming at you from all sides, and it's like, tennis balls being flung at you, and you just have to beat it away until you see one coming that looks good, and you say, okay, I'm going to give this one a chance. Does that make any sense?
It does make a lot of sense. You know, I guess I would like to know how to note that one that's coming at you. And that's part of what you do. You're helping us figure this out. And part of your advice is to continue interacting with music in a very tangible way. So how do you mean?
Well, the obvious one, and it's almost a cliche these days, but, purchase physical media. It really makes a difference when you have something tactile in your hands, when you have artwork and liner notes, and when you yourself lift your hand to push a button or drop a needle on music. I see a lot of young people discovering physical music, and their whole relationship to it changes for the better.
All right, so buy music, actual music. What else? How should we interact with new music?
Well, live music is really just a no-brainer. I can't tell you how many times my reaction to a piece of music has changed by seeing it performed live. Usually for the better, sometimes for the worse. Also, you're in a room with, 500, 8,000, maybe 20,000 people, and you're sharing that just communal joy with so many people, which is... there's just nothing like it.
Well, I really love that idea. I think it's so important to kind of be with live music. But it goes against what everybody says about, once you're in your 30s, you probably have kids. It's harder to go out and see music. Then when you go, you feel like the old guy at the club. Does that happen to you?
Oh, yeah. You have to constantly banish that worry that you're the old person at the show. I still go to a lot of rap shows where I'm very much the oldest person there. I go to, punk shows. I go to warehouse shows. It's not my scene, according to the rules, but I don't know. When has music ever played by the rules? I think if you're there and you're passionate about it and maybe you know at least one or two other people there, it helps. But it's also kind of neat to be the outsider. It's also kind of neat to be the fly on the wall. That's how it was when I first started going to concerts, and it was terrifying. But I learned from it.
Did you once have a more adventurous and intimate relationship with music, feeling like you don't know where to find new artists? Well, Gabe Moline is with us. He's music editor at KQED Arts, and he's giving us some tips on how to keep discovering new music after 40. So going to see live bands, putting yourself out there, buying physical copies of music, I understand, why that really works. But they don't necessarily push you to try new music. You could just buy, the same old copies. You could go to see the same old bands. How do you suggest people actually find the new music?
My experience is, it really kind of comes from the crate digging world, looking through piles of records at record stores, at thrift stores, at junk stores, and just looking for something that catches my eye rather than my ear. But you can also make commitments. I mean, there are a number of very stupid ways that I make sure that I still like new music. And one of them is to commit to listening to one style of music that you hate for a week, solid. And, something really strange and beautiful happens when you do that. You may come out of it hating that style of music even more, or what's happened with me almost always is to have a new appreciation of it.
I'm curious of what you tried.
Well, in this piece, I mentioned the week that I listened solely to pop country radio. That was a couple years ago. And my goodness, so much of, you know, new modern pop country is very corny. Some of it is really poignant and really emotional. And my main takeaway from that week is that country music is impeccably crafted. You know, country music is one of the last genres of music in America that employs songwriters full-time. There's something just really unique and cool about people striving to write a hit all day long and sometimes succeeding.
Well, you're also speaking to something, you know, the hit makers. When I was growing up, music was aimed at, for the most part, you know, that, what, 13-year-old to, what, 24-year-old kind of audience. There is this sense of the music that is written being young or purely nostalgic. You know, our sort of engagement with music is purely nostalgic for a time that was. How do people get knocked out of that nostalgia?
My answer might be a little strange, but listen to modern pop music. You know, listen to Katy Perry and listen to Taylor Swift. Listen to the music now that is being made, you know, mostly for that demographic, for kids. Not only will you find some really great songs, you might feel young again yourself. Also, you'll have something to talk about with your nieces and nephews at family gatherings.
Well, when I was in high school and middle school, actually, I had a group of friends. They were constantly passing around music. So how do you suggest that we maintain that kind of social aspect of music appreciation once you turn 40 and your peer groups are somewhat more constricted and somewhat less, you know, we can't sit around and make mixtapes anymore?
Yeah. You could if you wanted to, but you'd find a small audience among your friends who might be able to play them. I think the best way to share music is in person. I have so many conversations with people about music where they'll say, "Hey, have you heard this band from Toronto?" And I'll go, "No." "Have you heard this great band from Denver?" And they'll go, "No." And then we both promise that we'll go home and, you know, look them up and listen to them, and we never do, and that's the end of it. Really, it is just so rewarding to be in person with somebody listening to music and, you know, letting it wash over you and talking about it. And that's really going to just be the best impact. And not only is that good for them, but it's good for you as a listener. I mean, I think sharing music and sharing what you've discovered and why you like it is really important.
That's a beautiful sort of idea, getting together to listen to music.
I mean, it might fall under the sort of commitment idea of, you know, committing to listen to music that you don't like for a week. You know, you might make a weekly night where you invite friends over and everyone has to bring two songs, and you go around and you listen to everyone's two songs. Not everyone can make that type of commitment, but all the beautiful things need work at some point. You know, after 12 years of marriage, you realize we need to work to keep nurturing this. Children are beautiful things, and they require a lot of work, especially in their teenage years. And your relationship with music is the same. And at some point, you'll realize that it might be slowly slipping away from you. And if you catch it at the right time and you make a commitment to keep that relationship alive, you'll be in good hands.
Well, Gabe, thank you very much for sharing your musical philosophy with us.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Gabe Moline is music editor at KQED Arts in California. He recently wrote an essay for his 40th birthday called "Keep Listening, Notes on Turning 40 and Still Seeking Out New Music." You'll find a link to it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. After our interview with Gabe, we realized we almost missed a perfect opportunity to actually hear about some of the new music we should try out. After all, one of his biggest points is that we have to share new music if we want to discover it. We asked him to tell us about three artists he's been excited about recently.
I've been listening to a lot of Atlanta rap lately. The rapper Future has a new record called Dirty Sprite 2, which I think is just extraordinary. Where your ass was at, dog, when it was 1 feet? Where your ass was at, dog, then deep? It is the sound of someone at the bottom slowly clawing his way up. The production on it is so fresh, and his voice is really otherworldly. I love a new record by Autre Nevu. He made a record a couple years ago that I think owed a lot to 1980s production, but the songwriting was really incredible, and this new one is very sprawling and crazy. The first song on it is guided by his vocal melody, but there's these sped up and slowed down tape loops coming in and out of the mix. There's acoustic piano and upright bass. It's really something. I can't get tired of this record by Kamasi Washington called The Epic. He's a saxophone player from Southern California who assembled a large band, and it's very reminiscent of the spiritual exploratory jazz of the late 60s, really deep and rich, and I play it over and over and over again.
That's Gabe Moline, music editor at KQED in San Francisco, offering his picks for new music to try out right now. Well, one way we discover new music is through the podcast Song Exploder. Each episode interviews a songwriter or composer and breaks down one piece of music into its discrete parts. We learn about the process in which it was created and the influences that helped shape the piece. Song Exploder is produced by Rishikesh Hirwe. Here is another episode featuring the Australian musician Chet Faker.
The first thing I had for this song was that opening line. Dun-ga-dun-dun-dun-ga-dun. And I dreamt it. I woke up with it in my head in the middle of the night. And I have a voice memo of me like, I mean, my girlfriend was asleep in the bed next to me, so I was mumbling really quiet. It's like almost indecipherable. Boom, 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 boom. I'm always recording ideas and stuff. So it wasn't like, oh, okay, that's going to be a song. That was just a piece that got like put aside into my palette. And then after a few days, I was in the studio trying to cover David Essex, Rock On. Hey, rock and roll, rock on, ooh, my soul.
Hey, boogie-doo, DJ. He was this like heartthrob pinup boy from the 70s who had this like album. It was pretty soft, but there's a song in there, Rock On. Ah, it's awesome. So I went into the studio like I normally do and I was just messing around. I tracked the dun-ga-dun-ga-dun-ga-dun. And I knew that I could sing the David Essex part over the top of it, the vocals. Like, hey, kid, ooby-doo. Did you? Yeah, they so kind of fit. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. This can go with my Rock On cover. But it started to sound really good, and I was like, nah, I'm not doing this as a cover, you know? I want to write my own song. So, yeah, that's how I got to this part.
it was the bass line, but it ended up on the track being the Wurlitzer. I obviously tried to play it on bass first and realized I couldn't because I'd just bought a bass, you know? I didn't know what I was doing. And I couldn't play. Like, a lot of it's really me just playing a section and copy and pasting it. I can play it now, but I played literally one note for the whole song. And then I put drums. These claps were done in my home studio in my mum's garage. I was living with my girlfriend at the time, and I would drive each day to the studio, which is where I first started recording, which was like had like a tin roof, so I couldn't record when it was raining or if there was wind because the trees would brush on the roof. I think I spend the most time on drum sounds than anything else. I spend hours looking for a hi-hat sound. Because the thing with drum sounds is it needs to sound like it's in one cohesive space. You can't have like a hat that's like really close sounding and then a kick that has distance, or it just puts people off and it loses that groove. The pocket's got to come from sounding like it's a real player. A lot of people put me in that electronic area, but a lot of that's because I don't have the real instruments or the capacity to play them or record them how I want. So I always envisioned kind of realer drums, and I think my drum samples are getting more and more like that. I was in love, and you only fall in love a couple of times in your life, like depending how lucky you are. And I have this like inbuilt like distaste for anything that's so cheesy in a way, but I kind of had to sing that, you know? I had to sing that.
You gotta know I'm feeling love made of gold. I never loved another one, another you. It's gotta be love, I said it. You gotta know I'm feeling love.
When you're so in love, you don't care what anyone thinks, and you actually just want everyone to know that you're in love. You know, and you're annoying. I was kind of channeling that guy or that part of me that wanted to like stand on a mountain and shout it out, you know? And in a way, that attitude allowed me to do things in this song that I would say would err on the cheesier side of things that I usually wouldn't do, because it was playing on that lovesick kind of vibe. I think this song is the highest I've sung in a recording ever. Feeling love. It's like way up there, you know? I was playing off that like weak, fragile voice, but then harmonizing in the chorus with like big, brash, masculine backing vocals, you know? Harmonizing, I'm feeling love, you know? That was the shout off the mountain top kind of thing. Like I was literally shouting it.
You gotta know I'm feeling love, made it go. I'll never love her. Another one, another you. It's gotta be love, I said it.
The identity of a song, which is often the hook or the chorus, that's the hardest. Every other aspect of a song you can work away at and improve. You can't work and work and work and get a good chorus. You either have it or you don't.
A heart will swell before it's hardened. With the flick of the hair, it can make you old.
A flick of the hair can make you old. That's like you're so attracted to someone. This person can just do the smallest thing and it can just make you feel like, you know, like you're done. In this case, it was just like how this girl would like flick her hair and you just be like, oh. For me, it's like a punch in the guts. It's not always a good thing, love. It's kind of punishment because you just want to be with them all the time. Well, the guitar falls in again to that cheesy. I mean, the line is like, dun, 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 dun. Like, that is just the cheesiest, you know what I mean? It's like, dude with the window down, driving, like, you know, down the highway with the shades on. It was okay, because I was in that zone.
the outro, it's like a beat with a loop, and I really like the vibe of that to get out of the ridiculous territory that this song took itself. This song is so like grand, it's so ridiculous. I couldn't wait for another song, the next track, to bring it back. I had to reset it before the audio stopped, you know? An audio version of just being like, no, just relax. Let's come back to reality, you know?
And now, here's Gold by Chet Faker in its entirety.
You gotta know, I'm feeling love, made of gold. I never loved another one, another you. It's gotta be love, I said it. You gotta know, I'm feeling love. You gotta know, I'm feeling love.
And that was Nicholas James Murphy, also known as Chet Faker, talking there with Hrishikesh Hirway, host of the podcast Song Exploder. To hear more episodes, subscribe to Song Exploder on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our brand new podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, where I sit down with great writers to talk about how they conjure and craft their work and find out what it really takes to get pen to paper, finger to keyboard. We are really excited about it. Here's just a taste from a recent episode with Patti Smith.
Now, what's the thing called? Writer's Workshop?
Yes, 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
Oh. Hi, I'm Patti Smith, and we're at 10 Minutes Writer's Workshop.
So what do you think is harder for you to write, the first sentence or the last sentence?
Well, I think that the first and the last sentence, for me, are not hard at all. They seem to come as a gift. The hardest part is the middle. The first line and the last line, which I find are so infinitely important, always come to me without a problem. It's really the wrestling with all the stuff in between.
And when you're wrestling with that stuff in the middle, are there any personal habits that you would encourage writers to take up or avoid to be more productive?
Well, I wouldn't presume to tell anybody anything, but I think having routine is really helpful. For me, I get up early, go to a cafe, or if I don't have a cafe to go to my desk or somewhere early in the morning, the coffee, preferably when the city is sleeping, when people are sleeping, when you seem to own the universe, and spend some time with yourself writing and make that a habit. I try to do that every day. And I think, you know, writing is, a lot of it is discipline and labor. And we can be inspired at any time, you know, in the middle of the night, we wake up at 3 a.m. But there's so much labor intensive work that needs to be done. It's good to develop a work ethic and a discipline. Also, to always have a notebook somewhere on you, or, you know, some piece of paper, some scrap, some pencil stub, because something comes to you at all these inopportune times, and there's nothing worse than thinking you have the line of your life and no pencil or piece of paper at hand.
So what is your personal worst distraction from getting work done?
Detective shows. If I'm supposed to be working and there's a new George Gently or some marathon, you know, every once in a while there's some, if I'm lucky, some CSI Miami marathon or something, that can be a little distraction. And it's a new distraction for me because for years and years I didn't even watch TV. But since my detective addiction, I found that I have to discipline myself a little sometimes and do my work.
And that was Patti Smith from our brand new podcast, The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. If you'd like to hear the rest of the conversation, and believe me, you do, search for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. Or if it's easier for you, you'll find the link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And if you like it, please give it a rating and tell a friend. Spread it word of mouth style. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Bye.